This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
We got a lot of Valve fans here, clearly, right? Just a disclaimer, unfortunately, I have fallen victim to Melbourne's four seasons in one day, and it's wreaked havoc on my sinuses. So if I sound like a 50-year chain smoker, apologies, okay? It's a huge honor to be here today, and thank you so much for sparing us your time. For those who don't know me, my name's Reese Riley. I host a YouTube channel called Kiwi Talks, where I interview game developers. I've spoken to over 100 game devs from studios such as Nintendo, Bethesda, Sony, Rockstar, and of course Valve, which leads me to the person on my left, who worked at Valve for quite a substantial amount of years, and he worked on games such as Half-Life 2, which should warrant a huge applause, I think. He also worked on Portal, Left 4 Dead, and of course he was the project lead on, my opinion, still Valve's magnum opus, Portal 2. So, with that being said, please give a huge welcome to Josh Weyer. How you doing, man?
Yeah, pretty good. I'm kind of falling victim to the same allergy, so between the two of us, we'll be doing a lot of coughing,
yeah.
So I apologize ahead of time. But yeah, thanks for everybody for turning out. These two games are kind of getting old now. I mean, we're coming up on 20 years with Half-Life 2, but it's amazing to see so many people turn out for that, and I'm just really humbled to have you here, so thank you.
So, yeah, you can clap again. Why not? So I actually interviewed Josh, I think in 2022, and we did a deep dive on Portal 2. I highly recommend that you check it out if you haven't. But today we're going to tread some new ground, hopefully. So time is of the essence with these things, so I thought best we get into it.
Let's do it.
So there's something that's been bugging me for a while in terms of Valve, and it's like, what is the secret sauce to Valve games? Why are they so successful? Can you please let us in on the secret?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting with games because I had worked at places before Valve, and the process was always very much you kind of did your best work, you got it to the finish line, and you kind of had a chance to really look at it all together and go, I would change this, I would change that. And I think at Valve we were really fortunate to really have enough runway to get to that point where all your favorite games from Valve were all terrible at some point. And we're all able as a team to kind of sit back and look at it and go, let's pull this apart. And we were fortunate at Valve, I think, to have the staff and I think also just the ability to rip our games back apart, kind of look at them and say, like, okay, this part's really good, this part's really good, let's kind of put it back together this way. I mean, I guess the way I think about it is like in a movie, you're going to write the script, you're going to do the, kind of the layouts, and you're going to do the shots.
Yeah.
But then when you get into the editing room, you kind of go, that's kind of where the movie comes together, and games really aren't any different. So we never really worked with this design document, because the minute we wrote a design document, it would be out of date. Like, who cares? Because, and that's kind of what you want with games too, right? Because we have all these talented people who are all kind of all these ideas. Why would we ever say, well, in the design doc, it says we should do this, right? We're always kind of changing things. And so I think that constant iteration was a big deal, but also playtesting. Like, we really took playtesting super seriously because a lot of times as designers, you can say like, well, I'm really smart. I know what my design is going to be great. And people would hash it out. And you spend all this time like arguing about whose idea was the best. But then you put it in front of somebody and they'd play it. And that really smart designer would watch their really smart design go really terribly. And after 10 times of that, you kind of go, okay, maybe we'll test this instead of me kind of putting my ego up here. And so I think as a company, we were able to go, hey, you know, we're going to do science. We're going to take our best guess. We're going to talk about it. We're going to know what we're going for. But then we're going to put that in front of people, and we're going to collect that data, and we're going to be as smart as we can about getting people to look at those things and tear it apart and kind of understand what they're doing. And Portal 2 was, I think, the biggest example of that, because every week we tested that. That was like, we knew what we wanted to do, we knew what we were testing, we put it down to science, we saw what people did, and then we kind of ripped it up and did it again. So I think without that process, if you're just kind of going, yeah, we know what we're doing, or your publisher comes to you and goes, yeah, that's good enough, we're going to put that out, you know, because I definitely feel for a lot of game design, you know, companies, that's kind of what ends up happening to them. But luckily with Valve, we didn't have that. We could take as much time as we needed, because we knew that if we make a good product, even though we would get a lot of crap about it, it's okay if we're late as long as it's good, but nobody was going to thank us for putting out a bad game on time, so that was kind of our mantra, was to go, we just have to get it right.
Easier said than done, though.
That's true.
Now, I wanted to ask you about Steam, because obviously it's something we take for granted now, but there was a time where its success was uncertain, for sure. But yeah. what was the vibe like at Valve when the first idea came about with Steam? Were you guys on board? Were you skeptical? What was the vibe?
No, I remember when they first showed us Steam. So the original iteration of Steam was basically this idea where, are you going to start playing the game and it's going to download it as you play it? And so, you know, you could start Half-Life, the original Half-Life, immediately, and as you're playing it, it's downloading everything, and it sounded really great on paper. But most of us looked at it and we're like, this is kind of dumb. We don't get it. We're going to go back to working on HL2. And luckily, Gabe was in charge of that, not us. we just focused on the games. But yeah, it was an interesting time, I think, for the company, because we had worked on Half-Life, and it had done super well, and the business guys are kind of like, like it did really well, but if we want to grow and get bigger and, you know, hit all these aspirations, like the gaming industry at that time was really difficult. There wasn't a lot of money in it, even though it seemed like it. Like you could have a big mega hit, but you weren't like swimming in cash, especially if you're like, well, we got to bankroll this next big hit, and especially on Valve time, like you're not talking a couple years, right? It takes a long time. So I think Steam is really thinking, Gabe was really thinking about that, and the biz guys are really thinking about that. Like, how do we take these things that we're laboring over and are being really successful and turn that into something that's more profitable for us in this industry that wasn't really necessarily always, you know, the best for that? So I think Steam and microtransactions and a lot of those things were kind of coming from that world. Plus just, you know, having that store and having that ability for us to do cool things with.
Do you remember the turning point where you're like, oh, okay, I am so on board with this?
I think there were two things internally at the company. One was, so usually when we'd release a game, you would kind of put it out there, and back in the day it was all physical, so you'd go print the discs, and then maybe 3 weeks later it would be on a store shelf and you'd come across it. So there wasn't this awesome, like, yay, we shipped it. But Steam was really cool because you could actually literally have the whole team there pushing the button that released it to everyone, and then we'd go run back and check, you know, whatever the I guess it was, right, it was the biggest at the time. And so that was really cool. We would build, like, these crazy things. Like, one of the engineers had built this huge, like, launch pad, and there's, like, a key and all these things that we do. So we made, you know, this big, big to-do of it. And that was really cool as a team because we worked so hard on these things. And just having that camaraderie and that focal point to, like, push that button was really cool. But then one of the things I also enjoyed about Steam, because, I mean, the business parts of Steam are obvious, but it was really fun in Portal 2 because when we were working on it, we had kind of been given Portal, and Portal tried to tie a bow on it and say, like, GLaDOS blew up, that's the end. And we were like, how are we going to move from this? And we had some ideas, and a bunch of us sat down and we're like, we happen to have this platform where we can kind of go back and retroactively do things, and we can mess with a community, and we can kind of change what history was in a fun way that's us with our audience, not just us coming in and do what we want. So when the original Portal 2 announcement was coming out, we went back and did the ARG, and a big part of that was us being able to go back and ship things into Portal that didn't originally exist. And without Steam, there would have been no easy way to do that, right? We would have shipped those discs, and that would have been the end. So I think for me, that ability to continue to have that dialogue with our audience in like a fun and subversive way almost, things that they don't expect and they don't see coming, was really fun. Because when those things showed up in Portal, people were like, what is this? We had never done anything like that before, and then that kind of led to this whole ARG and this whole huge thing, and that was just tons of fun.
Yeah, it's interesting because game devs are only as good as the tools that they have, right?
Mm,
so
yeah.
How did the Source engine really play a part in how Portal and Half-Life ended up being?
What they were, yeah. It's interesting because I think if you're going to create something, you really have to think about your tools, because your tools really shape kind of what you do more than what you'd think. Excuse me. As an example, you know, back in the 90s, I used to work on music stuff, and they had what were called trackers back then. I don't know if anyone worked on that, but this was like pre-Windows, way back in the days. It's like basically making music with Excel spreadsheets. It was awful. But a lot of electronic music came out of that, and a lot of the way that electronic music sounded, especially like its repetition or the way it was kind of made up, came from those tools, right? It was really hard to do anything else, so people did those things, and so electronic music in a lot of ways was shaped by those tools. And I think if you look at Portal, I believe when we got it, it was like a third-person game, but when it was pulled into Source, you know, when the DigiPen guys came in and they're like, okay, we're going to make this a Source engine game, Source was built for Half-Life, right? And then Half-Life 2. So it was a first-person game. It didn't have a lot of things built into it. So right away, they were kind of like, okay, well, it'll be a first-person game because it's really hard to do anything else. And the original Portal team, and I wasn't part of that team, that was a smaller team that we had hired out of DigiPen, they were kind of like almost literally in a closet, and nobody was really paying attention to them because we're like, you know, we were busy on the episodes and TF and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
So I think they were just coming in going, okay, like, how are we going to make this work? And so the Source engine led them down a bunch of creative constraint paths, and I think also that's why, a big reason why I was in the Half-Life universe, because they were like, well, we could try to make our own art style with one artist, and or, you know, we could leverage what we have with the Half-Life universe. And I think what that team did so well is they took those constraints and they really made them strengths for themselves versus that being something that hindered them, right? They were able to say, like, yeah, we're going to put it in this world that lets us, like, tag into all these amazing things, and being in first person. Like, I think Portal was really interesting because if you play chess, chess is kind of puzzly, right? It's like a puzzle game, but it's very abstracted.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah.
You're moving pieces, you're not in peril. But I think making it first person and making you on that chessboard and you be in peril and you be part of that story, all of those things kind of led on from the tools that we had. So I think that was kind of an interesting thing. And we adopted those constraints in Portal 2, and we were like, oh, these are great. We're going to use these in all these interesting ways. In a way that if you had a wide open canvas, you might not, right? You might never have found those creative solutions.
Yeah. It's interesting. Last year when The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom came out, there were a whole bunch of programmers online going, oh my god, physics, so amazing, the advanced physics. But people often forget that you guys were at the forefront with Half-Life 2 in regards to advanced physics, if you just think about the gravity gun. Can you talk about some of the physics and how that all worked and the challenges with that?
Yeah, so I was involved in the gravity gun a little bit. Steve Bond, who if you played the Half-Life games originally, he did all the grunts and the soldiers. He was a really cool AI guy. And then Jay Stelly, who was kind of like one of the main programmers at Valve, he had taken physics at that time and kind of implemented it, and he did an incredibly deep dive, very stable for that time. Because you have to remember, like, if you go and look at the E3 demos when we talked about HL2, it was like a barrel falling down and hitting things and splashing in the water, and it blew everybody's mind. And it's so hard to think about that these days because we're so used to that. But at the time, that was a huge deal. So when we started, we didn't know what to do with physics, because when we first had it, it was kind of janky. It didn't always work. We didn't know how much we could hang off that. And Jay just like kept working and kept finding all these ways to make it believable and plausible and feel right. So as we went, the original physics gun was something much more akin to what Gary's mod ended up having, which was like you'd have a little gun and it would shoot a beam, and you could like pick things up and kind of move them around. And I think we called it the gluon gun, because you could also like click a button and it would put a little like glue point in space, and so you could like pin things together. And so the first implementation of the gun was basically us like building contraptions and like rocket sleds, and you could shoot a canister and it would go flying off. And it was all really cool, especially for the time. Like, it's a lot of what Gary's Mod and Tears of the Kingdom felt like.
Yeah.
But for Half-Life, we were like, I don't really see people sitting around spending 30 minutes making some rocket to jump over a cliff. And so we slowly kind of changed that into the more kind of kinetic, physical gun that it was. And at one point, we had had like we're like, well, we have to have ammo for this, right? Because of course you have to have ammo. That's what you do with guns. And then slowly we kind of realize, like, no, actually, we don't need that. And the whole game is going to revolve around this. And there was this big passive kind of going, like, all right, we need barrels everywhere. There has to be physics everywhere. You know, everywhere you have these opportunities to do those things, let's do that. And I think that ties back to what we talked about for us. The way we were able to make really good games is as that physics came online, we were able to kind of take that and go, okay, we really need to more deeply integrate that and then go back and do that over and over again versus us getting to the end and going, I wish we would have done more with that, you know, and then like, there you go, enjoy, and, you know, hope someone else did it for us.
Was there a lot of QA with the gravity gun?
Yeah, well, we were playing with it all the time. I mean, for us, physics was amazing too, right? Like, we'd see, like, a guy would fall over and ragdoll, and it was like, oh, that's the best thing ever. Like, you know, we spent, I mean, go back and count the exploding barrels in that game. You'll lose count really quickly. So yeah, we were just beating on it all the time. But Jay was like so singularly minded on getting it working that he just, every week it just got better and better. So by the end we stopped.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Thinking about it, we just kind of, I think that was part of what worked so well for it. It was just very plausible by the end. You know, you weren't seeing those kind of cracks. I mean, maybe if I went and looked at it now, I wouldn't feel that way. But at the time, it seemed bulletproof. So
yeah. with Metroidvania games, you obviously have a modular design so you can move rooms around. Mm. And obviously Portal and Portal 2 function fundamentally the same, where if something isn't working, you can move a room to somewhere else.
Yeah.
How did that actually work and benefit the game design?
Yeah. I think one of the biggest strengths Portal had in a lot of ways was having those test chambers, because it was such a perfect conceit for us to hang so much stuff around and do so many things with. And one of the tricks we used on Portal 2 is, like, in Half-Life 2, we had to pioneer this idea of, like, these orange boxes. So if you would see them, they would be, like, the level you knew, but it's all orange textures and it's very rough. The reason we had to do that was because somebody would sit down and make this beautiful track and it was immaculate, and then we go, oh, you're supposed to turn right here, not left, we want to change it, and they'd rip their hair out and be like, I spent so long making this look good. So we really quickly were like, all right, we need to do that pass last. And Portal was, we were able to go a little bit further because we had gotten the portals working so well that what a lot of people didn't know, and we didn't ship a ton of this because we baked them in, but for a long time what would happen is you'd get off the elevator and you would think you're walking out a door, but actually what you're doing is you're walking through a portal. And so in the editor, we'd have all these pieces all over the place and we would just kind of link them all up with portals that didn't have any kind of effects on them, or they were just like a literal portal. So that was great for development because we could just go, oh, actually we want this to go over here and we got to change this and do that. So by the end, we just had these big spreadsheets of things and it was, you know, got kind of crazy. But it was kind of a fun way for us to use portals in a way that nobody knew about but made our life so much easier. So.
It's interesting because when I've spoken to a lot of game developers, one of the criticisms they have of games these days is that they're too long. Mm. There's too much padding. I feel with Valve games that the pacing is phenomenal.
Mm.
You don't let the game be too long, or the single player games. What is the reason and how do you decide how long to make the games, whether it's Half-Life 2 or Portal 2?
Yeah. Again, a lot of that just came down to playtesting. So we would have a broad idea, right? We'd be like, okay, there's going to be three acts. There's going to be the beginning, where we're kind of like going from the ruined areas, specifically in Portal 2, and we're going to go into the clean areas. But what we found really quickly is, like, when the test chambers were kind of beat up and interesting and dirty, like, they looked really cool. And GLaDOS was slowly fixing them, and then suddenly you get to the pristine ones, and everyone's like, well, these look boring. Like, compared to what they were, they just weren't that interesting. So we're like, okay, now this would be a good time to kind of, like, break you out of that and get you into the next thing. And again, we'd kind of watch people, and we would know, like, all right, it's getting 2 hours into this area, and they look like they're getting bored or they're getting stressed. Because especially with Portal, like, the 10th puzzle you've gone through, if we don't give you a break, your brain's fried, you want to turn it off for the night, we wanted you to have breaks. We didn't want to, like, make you play a marathon, but at the same time, we didn't want to burn you out. So a lot of it was just kind of watching it and then kind of gut feel going, this is feeling a little long, let's do this. But I think it was fun in that game too because it let us throw you a bunch of curveballs because, again, the conceit in Portal was, you know, those laboratories. And they just set up this really good pattern, right? You go in the elevator, you do the puzzle, GLaDOS says some things to you, you get in another elevator, and we just get you in that mindset, and then we just have this perfect thing to just kind of throw you that curveball. Or we'd set you up, right? Wheatley would say, okay, in three chambers, we're going to do this thing. And then we're like, we're not going to do it in three chambers. And then he would come in early and kind of pull you along. And so we just kept trying to find ways to do that, like the false first ending when you think you're beating GLaDOS and then you get thrown into the underground. Like, we just kept trying to find all these ways to subvert what you thought was there. And I don't think that would have been as successful if Portal hadn't felt so rigid in some ways. It was kind of like you need to know the rule to break the rule. Like, we could set up really heavy rules and then, like, really subvert your expectations on them. So that was super fun. I think as designers, we would sit down and go, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and that was really neat. But on the other hand, there are sections where, you know, Wheatley, you know, spoilers if you haven't played it, Wheatley opens...
Everyone should have played it by now.
By now, it's too late. So Wheatley opens the doors and he's like, hey, come behind the scenes, and there's this whole chase scene. And we're like, great, there's going to be this great energy, we're going to keep you going. And then in the early days, that would go too long, and then people are like, I don't want to run anymore, I'm just like freaking out, I just want to go back to the nice puzzles we had. Or we would go, hey, let's throw them a puzzle just to keep, you know, make sure they know it's a puzzle game. So they're running, and then they have this 20-minute brain teaser where they're like, I don't know what to do, and you're like, well, okay, the running is kind of broken now. Like you do, clearly GLaDOS is not trying very hard because you've been in here scratching your head at this. And again, that was just testing and going, should we pull this out? Should we pull this out? And that's hard sometimes because you might have something that you love, and you're like, okay, for the sake of pacing, we should find somewhere else for this, or we should cut this. And, you know, you really have to keep that bigger picture in mind about that experience versus the kind of, you know, whatever small thing you've come up with. So,
What's Valve's approach to tutorials? Because they're very, very important. It's the first thing you see when you start a game, right?
Yeah. Again, I think Half-Life for the company sort of set the precedent where at the time, again, you have to kind of cast your memory back. Excuse me. It used to be, right, you'd start a game and then you'd go to the tutorial level and you'd learn everything and then you'd go into the real game and then you'd forget whatever we just told you, right? Because you were like, I don't remember. You told me 20 things.
That's common. Or
we put you under stress and do it. So I think Half-Life, their approach really was to say, this is before me, but their approach was to say, like, why don't we just teach you things in situ when they matter, right? You don't need to know how to crouch until we need you to crouch. And we can make sure that you crouch because you can't go anywhere if you don't crouch. And if we do it that way, then it feels natural and it feels a part of the game and it feels exciting. If we do it in a tutorial level, it's this weird fourth wall breaking thing that we don't like. So that was just something that I think, much like not having cutscenes for a lot of our single player games, that got kind of enshrined into the thinking. And so Portal was kind of an even harder version of that because it wasn't just, okay, you have to crouch, you have to jump. It's like, oh, by the way, there was this whole game and the whole part of that game before this game was to teach you how to use this mechanic, and now we have to kind of like try to catch you up on that. So that was an interesting challenge in itself because it was like the mega tutorial to like catch you up on the whole game. But again, we didn't want to like say, well, don't play this until you play that. And we didn't want to put you through some like boring thing because, I mean, half a Portal is learning things, right? Like,
yeah, that's right.
So we knew we could make that fun. It was just a bit of a hard thing to do.
But I think you did a very brilliant thing with Portal 2, and we spoke about this last time, using Super Metroid as an example, where you're revisiting places from the first game, right? But how far into development did that come into effect?
That was pretty early on, because we knew... I think at the time... And this is like, you know, we had 12 people on board and we were very early days. But we were thinking about it and we're like, how do we bring you back? How do we make this interesting? And again, there was this sterility to the first game with the test chambers. And some of that was intentional with the design. And there was a nice contrast when you got behind the scenes. And I had this idea, and you know, Super Metroid had been the genesis for that because I remember, well, the Super Nintendo, not the genesis. But I remember, I remember playing that game as a kid, and I was like, I loved Metroid, and there'd been this big gap, and then like there was this brand new thing. You're on the Super Nintendo, the graphics are different, and so you kind of come in backwards from the game, and they got to introduce it. So I really loved that idea. And yeah, we spent a long time kind of trying to get that right. And Laura DeBook, who was working on it at the time, she was, I remember the day, she brought in this concept and it was like, she had just taken a picture of one of the test chambers and like broken it and done some drawovers of like the all the vegetation coming in. And we were like, yes, that is it. And then everything kind of flew, you know, came out of there. But also at the time, Richard Lord, who, if you like all the animated cutscenes, not cutscenes, but like the little diorama things that were going on, like the turrets and all the little infographics videos, he was a big part of that. He had been working on like all the robot arms moving and stuff, so we're like, oh, okay, cool, we can use this to like articulate it and rebuild the things, and it fit with the story. So yeah, all these things kind of came together. And then I think we saw the value of going, oh, we can kind of reuse the portal training this way, right? We can literally use the same training because some of it, it would be hard-pressed to do it better. And if you've played that game, you're going to see those chambers and go, oh, I remember this chamber. I remember, oh, but it looks different. Oh, it's a little different.
Yeah.
So you're going to have that kind of nostalgic, fun thing. And I think the other thing that was cool about it is it's empowering, right? Like if you play Portal again and you know all the puzzles, you're like, I'm an expert, whatever, don't worry about it. And you're just like going through and you feel really good. So it wasn't a problem if you had played the game before, you were still having a fun time. But if you hadn't, you're like, what am I doing? What is a Portal? And you could still piece it together. And so I think, yeah, that came together really well. And I was happy that we didn't end up having to do something that was a little more fourth wall breaking than that.
One of the cool things about the Valve single player games is the way, I wouldn't even call them cutscenes, but you didn't really have pre-rendered cutscenes and you didn't really have in-engine cutscenes. They were more interactive dialogue scenes, I suppose.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do things that way?
Yeah, again, I think that a lot of that came from Half-Life. My guess is, so again, I wasn't involved in the original Half-Life that much, well, at all. That's how much. But it was... It was interesting because I think probably a lot of that at the time, there were two things. One was we wanted to keep you in the game. We didn't want it to be like, hey, you were having fun, but now you're going to watch this thing that we're telling you you don't want to watch. And you're like, but I wanted to look over there. And they're like, no. And I think that was important because, you know, you play Gordon or you play Chell, technically you're those characters, but really you're yourself, right? And I wanted to lean heavier into that on Portal 2 because it's really you playing, and I think a first-person perspective game has that ability, right? Like, if your character's not talking for you, if you're not being ripped out to see yourself, you can really be immersed in that game, and I always loved that. Like, I wanted to be the person in the game. I didn't want to play a character, per se. The other one I would say is probably a technical thing where we didn't really, like, later we came up with the Source, you know, movie stuff and all that for TF, but at that time we didn't have it. So it was kind of a great double thing. It was like, okay, we're going to not have this technology, but also we're going to like use it well. And for Half-Life 2, that was another thing that kind of got worked through because at the time, you have to cast your mind back again because we went from like the sock puppet from Half-Life to suddenly like, you know, the Alex facial things.
Yeah.
Like she can like make all these expressions and that was really amazing at the time. So they wanted to figure out a way to show all that off and really bring you into that world. So there was a whole little team dedicated just to doing those things. And so the rest of us were building track in the game and laying it out. And then this team would come through and go, and just like put a little, you know, interactive sequence where somebody would talk to you and go, okay, that's a little story piece there. And they'd go off and do another. And there are big ones like Kleiner's Lab where they just like lavished all these details on things. But I think that was important from a gameplay perspective because it didn't, you could do what you wanted. If you wanted to sit there and watch them and like interact with them, that was great. Now, I would say 90% of players would like grab their crowbar and like go smash every crate they could and like just act crazy. And that was always very sad watching the playtest because, you know, I didn't make these, but the guys who worked at them, they were just so crestfallen because they had lavished all this detail and people would be in a corner like trying to break something. And you're just like, could you please pay attention to the hard work that everyone has done? So that was pretty funny. And there was actually a point, I think, where we had thought about doing things where they would react to what you were doing, but the problem is then the game became like, what will they do if I do this? And we're like, I don't want to spend 90% of my time trying to figure out what players are going to do. So we just kind of ignored it and act like you were being a humane person and not running around like crazy, and that worked out. Because I think after a while as a player, you're like, okay, I get it. You're not going to play that game with me. That's fine.
Yeah, fair enough. What was the approach in terms of tricking players, in terms of the overlap with story and design, right? Because obviously Portal 1 and Portal 2 have a number of twists, so to speak. So how do the design and story interweave?
Yeah. So for Portal and for Portal 2, I worked quite a bit, with Eric Wolpaw and Jay Pinkerton, who did the writing. And that was probably one of the most amazing experiences in my career, was sitting in a room with those guys, just watching them work. They would just spend 2 hours coming up with every joke under the sun, and they probably could use like 1% of what they actually came up with. But that was just part of their thing, right? They would just throw out a bunch of stuff, and then they were really good at pulling it back. But part of how they worked is that they wanted kind of to wait to the last minute to set anything in stone, because we were, again, it's kind of like, if they went off and recorded a bunch of stuff, and then were like, hey, actually, instead of this part of the story, we're going to do this. It's like,
yeah.
All right, well, you guys spent 5 minutes making this choice, and you just wiped out like a week of our work. So they didn't want to do that. So smartly, they would kind of like put stuff off as long as they could. And as you know, the project lead, that would kind of drive me nuts sometimes, because I'm like, you guys got this, right? But no, that, you couldn't ask for better people to work with than those guys. But yeah, it was always an interesting back and forth, because the biggest one I can think of is like, so at the end of, another spoiler, at the end of the game, when you do the moonshot and you shoot that portal on the moon, that was kind of one of the more surreal experiences for me, because I was involved in most of the design stuff in the company, but at the very end, we were so busy that the people that were going to work on that went in a room and they came back and they're like, hey, I've got this great idea. You're going to shoot this thing on the moon. And I was like, okay, like, you guys sound really excited. I think
you
can make this work. Yeah, you do though. And it was, you know.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
They were happy with that. Sure, you shoot on the moon. Why not? The moon's white. Yeah. But I think the writers had to go back and go, okay, like, how are we going to do this? And it might have been a detail that nobody cared about, but they certainly did. So they kind of went back to it and were like, okay, like, Cave was importing moon dust, and moon dust is used for portals. And they kind of went back and just lavished all that back through the story to make sure that that was not just consistent. So when it happened, it didn't seem random. You kind of had this inkling that that was a thing that could happen. But they just did such a good job of like laying those seeds in a way that when it happened, it seemed obvious, but you never knew that's what was going to come, right? Like you never would have guessed that's what we're going to do, but then it didn't seem too absurd when we did, because they were pretty smart about doing that. So certainly for that one, it was a lot of just like designs coming up, the writers taking on board and going like, okay, how do we put our spin on this, and then also wait so that the design doesn't shift again and we have to redo this again. But yeah, they made that work. It was quite a crunch at the end of it, but yeah, they really pulled it off, obviously. So
did the moonshot fundamentally change the boss fight with Wheatley at the end, or was it always set in stone that way?
It was, if I recall, and again, I was mostly in spreadsheet hell at this point. I think the moonshot was before the rest of it, because it was kind of like, what's the big payoff? How do we make this work? And it was kind of like, okay, we've got this idea. We're going to do this thing. And we had talked about it previously. So one of the things that we wanted to do for Portal 2 that we didn't really do, we kind of did, we amused ourselves with this idea of having fake credits, because Portal's credits were obviously very iconic, and we knew that we had to do that for Portal 2, but we were joking like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if you did certain things in the game where we just rolled the credits? like you jumped in the hole, great, you're dead, here, roll the credits, and we do that. So one of the jokes we had was like, oh, you see the moon through the roof, and you shoot a portal, and you get sucked off in the space, and you die, and we roll the credits, and you know, it's a funny thing. So that didn't work out in that way, but it's something that we kind of like kept in the back of our heads, and it moved forward into the end of the game. But there was another piece of that, which was we really liked the cores, because early on in Portal 2, when we were thinking about the different mechanics you could do, we'd kind of set up this hub structure, so you could like do all the catapults and do all the projected walls and do all those things. And down each one, you would find like a sphere that you would bring back, because we really enjoyed the spheres from the first game, the little things you would add on to GLaDOS, or take off GLaDOS in that case. The writers could just go ham with that, and it was really fun. And that's kind of where Wheatley came out of, because we had this whole sequence. I'm going to a random topic, but
that's all right.
We
guys like it, right?
I appreciate it. Yeah, yeah. We so we had these spheres, and they didn't have much personality. And I remember at the time, you just pick them up. Like, you, there was like little puzzles, and some of these worked into the boss fights. So like the walls that would come up and shield you, and you'd have to go behind them. That all came out of that as just little experiments. But at one point, you'd like pick up these spheres, and they'd talk to you. And people were walking, and somebody was walking and accidentally dropped it down the stairs, and we were like, oh my God, the sphere has to go boop, and like be like super upset that you did it. And then from there, we were kind of like, yes, this is what we need to do. So Wheatley sort of grew out of that, where it was like, we don't just want a sphere, we want this like companion that can come with you, but we don't want humans because Portal isn't really about humans per se. And there's all these problems that come with it. It'd be much more fun if you can drop this guy down the stairs and he gets mad at you. And then pairing that up with Stephen Merchant was like, okay, great. Like,
we're set.
It's good to go. We're good to go. Yeah. And so all those little things, you know, and again, this is part of why I think we could make the games as good as we hopefully made them, is that we could, you know, throw all these ideas out there, throw everything against the wall, and be okay going, we probably won't ship that, but let's put it on the shelf. And that way, it was always nice because when we're sitting in a meeting scratching our head, we're like, oh yeah, that thing that we had, this has a better place now. Like, now this fits into what we're doing, and you could pick that up and you could kind of rehabilitate that idea into something kind of much bigger than it would have been otherwise, because you had kind of a better sense for where it was going to fit into the game. So I think for us, it was always just like, whatever crazy thing you can come up with, put it in there. We can always cut it, but, you know, even that cut material can find its way back to, you know, having a life again, which was always, you know, pretty cool, pretty fun to see.
Where do finales usually fit in within the Valve structure? Some game devs I speak to, they actually start with the end first and then work their way back. Some start with the tutorial section, but in the case with Valve, how do they usually structure endings? Because obviously the moonshot came quite late. So.
It did, yeah. Yeah, usually the way we would talk about it is we would think about building the end first in some respects, because sort of the perverse thing about making a game is you're the best at making it the minute you ship it and you can't do it anymore, right? Because you have the most knowledge, you have the most ability. So yeah. A lot of times that's why people want to make DLC, because they're like, we've got all these ideas and we know how to do this really well, and now we're being cut off. But for Portal, I think it was a different beast, because in Half-Life 2, it was, all right, we're working on the canals or we're working on this part, and it was such a big project that we had, like, you know, groups of people going off to do those things, and they would kind of try to put it back together in a way that made sense. Like in Half-Life 2, you know, I worked on the canals, I worked on the end of the game, and we kind of would come in saying, okay, we're starting here, the story guys would tell us, this is your story beat, make a bunch of track, and then we would hand off here. So we knew, okay, you're gonna go through the canals and get to the power plant, go off the cliff. I don't care what happens after that, that's another team's worry, but we'd all kind of agree on the middle points. But Portal was a bit different because we were a small team for so long that we didn't need to do that. We were all kind of working on the same thing.
Yeah.
And because so many of the chambers were similar, we could just like bang out chambers and just worry about the design, and then the setting could kind of flow in afterwards. You know, like when you're doing the underground areas, that was like its whole other big challenge. But as far as finales, yeah, we had kind of put that off because we were like, okay, we know that we want this to come down with Wheatley, but how are we going to do it? And Portal's not really it's not really a reflexy game. Like, we made a real point in Portal 2 to make it less kind of skill capped than the first game. This first game had a lot of acrobatics, and I think, you know, I had said that halfway through the game, you cut out half your players because they couldn't do a certain move,
yeah,
and we were like, well, that's a real shame. Like, half of the players didn't ever get to the twist. Like, who wants that?
Yeah.
And so the boss was kind of like, okay, how do we take everything? We always wanted this culmination, because when we would make something, it was kind of like, introduce you to a mechanic, do a couple quizzes to make sure you had a few ways to think about it. But then we always had the graduation at the end, which was like, now we're really going to make you think in some lateral way, but you're going to feel like a genius when you do it, even though everyone's going to feel like a genius because hopefully we've worked it out that way.
Well,
but that's how you're going to feel, and that was important. So the boss was like the super culmination of that, right? Which is like, all right, we want all these characters to come back. We want the paint to be there. The gels to be there. And so that just took a lot of iteration. Because again, it was like, oh, I'm having this fun boss battle. It's going really well. Now I'm stuck. And, you know, now the game has to wait for 20 minutes while trying to pretend like there's this like fuse that's not really going. So a lot of it was just coming down to like you going, I see what I want to do. I'm going to execute it. We're not going to make execution too terrible because that's not fun. And we just kind of got to a place where it was funny and pretty fast and felt good. And then we had the good payoff of the moonshot. And so between all those things, it was like, okay, that's where we need to be. But I remember people just really drilled down on that and spent a long time just kind of revising that and trying to get that all right.
Yeah. Final question before we wrap up for Q&A, but I'm sure there's some game devs in the audience as well. I mean, obviously, things are very volatile at the moment, and a lot of game devs I speak to, things don't come together towards the end of development, but I've heard that often they have despair during development. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't, I don't know. But what would be your advice to game developers who are in that space?
Yeah, it's hard. I spent most of Portal 2 going, oh God, I'm going to be the guy that screws this up, right? Like, I'm going to be the guy who takes Portal and makes everybody hate it. You know, it's a team effort, but I took it on myself. Or this is going to be the game where people are like, well, that's it, Valve's had it.
Yeah.
Because it was hard, right? Like, I think we want to look back and we want to say, oh, it was easy. We did this thing, we were super smart, and it's easy to kind of go back and retcon what it was. But I think if you're doing anything worthwhile, and I think if you're doing anything that's really amazing, it has to be really difficult, right? Because if it wasn't, great, everyone
What's
can
the point?
Do that, right? That's part of it. It's being so hard. So a lot of times, I mean, especially in the beginning, because we had started with a different mechanic than Portal, which was the F-stop mechanic, and so we felt that the company was telling us, take this mechanic and make Portal 2, and we were just kind of like beating our head against the wall going, this is cool, but it's not Portal, and I don't know what to do with it. And there was just so much like, oh my God, like what's going on with this? And it took us, I think, at the time Left 4 Dead had come out, and the way the company worked is like when we were gonna ship something, like kind of everyone would be all hands on deck to work on that. And so when that happened, you know, the small team that was working on Portal 2, a lot of those people went off to help ship Left 4 Dead, and me and two other people kind of stayed behind, and we worked on like a Xbox Live edition. I don't think it was Xbox, it was like Xbox Arcade, if you guys remember. That was like back when it was a big deal to download games. And so we made this kind of small edition, and that helped us step back and go, hey, let's reevaluate where we are. This is hard, but let's do it in a different way and just keep grinding forward. So I think, yeah, just knowing that it's hard for everybody, and if it's not hard, then you're probably not doing something that's hard enough, right? It's kind of like you want to pick the thing that's so incredibly hard that you're lucky if you get half of it done because you picked a hard thing to do. And even at, you know, I felt like I was working with people at the top of their careers, and we were still like just grinding and working super hard at it. And you know, I hope that comes through as being a successful thing. I think it did, but yeah, it's just know that, yeah, just keep going.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, we're going to wrap up there for Q&A. However, just to make this a tad more exciting, wrong pocket, I am going to offer $50 to whoever asks the best question. All right. So if you've got a lame question, you better rethink it.
Yeah.
Because you could potentially lose $50. So right here, I don't know if the camera guys want to zoom in on it. So, there we go. So, someone's coming around with a microphone, so stick your hands up and ask a good question, because Josh is taking time out to be here. Cool.
Hi, so you said the moonshot came pretty late in development. Was there anything else that, once you came up with it and you thought it was a really good idea, you went back and probably changed, like, a minuscule amount of work that done beforehand to, like, do you think significantly improve the overall experience?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that. So, say it again.
Yeah, so you came up with the moonshot late. Was there anything else you went back and changed a lot of stuff to fit in because you thought it was a really good idea?
Oh, yeah, it's hard to remember, to be honest, because there were so many things that, yeah, we would just, there's things that we took out that I think was probably a better idea. Like, we had like a bullet time, and we decided that that didn't really work out for us, so we didn't do that. I'm trying to think what else. I don't have a good answer for you on that one, because I feel like most things didn't really go that way. So no, I don't have a good answer on that one. I can't think of anything else in particular that we did that way.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
Jeez, there's so many hands. They want $50, eh?
I know. It's $25.
So I'm speaking on behalf of like a big part of the portal community. So a lot of people are researching like the, you know, portal to beta. What is some interesting part of development for the portal to beta, like when you're working on it?
Sorry, it's hard for me to hear up here. Can you say it again?
What are some interesting parts of the development?
It was an interesting one, I think, for us because we had started with, let's see, maybe 10, 12 people, and that had carried us through a lot of it. And then by the end, we were up to 100 people. So I think one of the most interesting things was finding a way to go from this small core team that was really intimate and working on things into suddenly, like, branching off a bunch of these little teams that could all come together and work together. That was a big thing that took me a lot of time, just trying to get the product in people's head and talk to them about. So I think, yeah, just finding a way to organically within the company, because Valve was very, like, I'm not there anymore. We didn't used to be very, I don't know if we're still structured that way. I'm not part of it. Anyway. There wasn't a lot of structure, and so it was kind of an interesting thing to try to like pull a team together and get everybody to pull in the same direction without ever pulling rank. And I think it was always an interesting thing to figure out how we could get everybody on board and moving in the same direction. And that wasn't just a gameplay thing, but I think more of a cultural thing. And that was kind of an interesting thing, I think, to try to wrap our heads around.
The amount of hands is crazy, honestly.
I'm very curious on the creative process of the part where he kills you.
Yeah, I love that. I'm glad you brought that up. I was sitting at, so David Sawyer did a ton of work, and he was a good friend. And I was sitting at his desk while we worked out the timing on that. And that was another thing I liked about Steam is that, you know, I remember sitting there and we were like, oh, let's call it the part where he kills you. And Dave's like, oh, yeah. And then I'm going to make an achievement pop up and I'm going to make this other thing pop up. Like he spent so much time like doing it and going, oh, it's not quite right. I got to go wipe out that achievement for myself. And then coming back and like tweaking it again. And he was just so thrilled. But I loved Portal for that because we could do those kind of like fourth wall meta things. Yeah, exactly. Whereas, like, and if you did that in Half-Life, I think people would be like, eh. But in Portal, it's like, yeah, it just totally fits it. And we did funny stuff like that, too. I remember at a certain point, we had set a deadline, or we had said we're going to ship in, I don't know, January. And then we decided, oh, actually, because of certification, we have to slip, like, by 2 months. And we were like, this is kind of embarrassing. We have to put out another press release. And, you know, the writers were like, we got this, don't worry about it. And they just wrote this like super funny press release about how it was the shortest slip in the history of gaming and we were patting ourselves on the back. And I love Portal for that because we could be absurd that way and it was kind of like, even in a stupid press release about us slipping, we could kind of interact with fans in a cool way that I feel like other things just can't do. So yeah, that was a really fun one for me to work with Dave on that one.
Hey, I was just wondering, out of Portal and Portal 2, what was the hardest test chamber or section for you to make, and did you ever think of, did you ever make like a test chamber or section that you just had to scrap because it was just too hard?
Yes, we left many on the cutting room floor. again, we play tested so much that there were a few that we kind of went, yeah, that's never going to work. The hardest part that we did ship, I think, actually wasn't any of the chambers, it was the underground area. Because I think people had this aspirational sense of like, oh, it's just like, I want to be in Half-Life 2, but I want to use the portal gun, it's going to be great. And then you put them in that environment, and they go, I don't know what to do. And then they would, they would stop thinking with portals, and they would switch back into Half-Life 2 mode, and like they wanted a crowbar, and we're like, no, you've got this amazing tool, please go have fun with it. So that took a long time to try to like get them to understand. The other big one we cut, I think, was, and I've talked about this before, is one of the gels we used to have was a gel where you could like stick it on things, then you could like walk on those surfaces. But it instantly made people puke. It was just terrible. Like, they were just, we were like, this is super cool, but we're never going to ship that. So we just had to cut it. And that was a shame, but because people had put a bunch of work into it. But I think we pretty much all were like, yeah, no, we can't do that.
Given all the time and effort you put into creating these games, what's your opinion on speedrunners?
Oh, I love it. It's an interesting thing because they weren't really around in my time. Like, I feel like an old gray beard. But we'd see it sometimes, but there wasn't, like, the Twitch culture around it and watching it. And I love watching speedrunning now. Like, I'm always just so... I think for me as a developer, it's funny because you can kind of feel empathy for the designers watching and going, oh, God, what did they just do? But I love it. To me, it feels like a way for fans to sort of be in the world longer and to get extra content out of it. So it's never bothered me. It's like, oh, you love this game enough that you're willing to go to insane lengths to do these things. So I love it. I love watching it. I love seeing those things. Yeah. I don't have the patience to do it, but...
hi there. I just wanted to quickly ask, what was the hardest part of Portal 2 to implement, like the gels or whatever?
Yes. I think the hardest things probably weren't the things you ever knew were there. If you go back now and you play Portal 1 and then you play Portal 2, you'll kind of realize how much work went into like not making you sick and not making things pop and look weird when you go through the portals. So David Kircher was from the original DigiPen team, and he worked on the original Portal. He made that technology. And he spent so much time in Portal 2 just like pouring himself into that to make sure, like, okay, if you come through a portal this way, you want to rotate it nicely and do all these things. And I think the other thing we had is if you play the original game, there'll be a lot of places where, like, you put a portal on the ground and you put it behind you and you jump down and you're really excited, then you barely hit the edge and you stop and you're like, oh, and I got to go back. So we did a lot of work where if you're going towards a portal and you're not touching anything and you weren't going to make it, we'd kind of push you to make sure you got there. If you were carrying a box, you would take that with you. So those are things that hopefully nobody ever knew about, but when they go away, you really feel it, like it's a really big deal. And they were incredibly subtle and they were incredibly nuanced. So those are probably, apart from the underground, getting that work, that was probably the biggest tech work, was making those things work.
The PAX person's getting quite a lot of exercise. Good cardio day.
That's true, yeah.
Thank you. As someone that's in the industry, and you've been in the industry for a long time, for those people that are in the industry, what made the people that you've worked with stand out, or the people that you really loved working with the most, what made you think of them that way? What makes them, you look back on working with them and go, wow, I'd love like to work with them again? What can people in the industry do like myself that make people want to work with me or have that experience, like that kind of experience?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. I really enjoyed, I think, working with just about everybody at Valve because everyone was just so passionate about what they did. I had so many people come to me and go, I've got this crazy idea that I'd kind of cringe at, but I was like, if you're passionate, I really feel like you're going to make this work. And there are very few times that was ever proven to be incorrect. Like, people would put that work in and do it. I think for me, a big thing that helped was product thinking. One of the big things, and I guess this is another reason that I felt Valve could make successful titles, is that we really pushed from a product standpoint. So it wasn't just going, I'm making this art, I'm going to make this art the best I can. It was, where does my art fit into everything? Or how could I change this in such a way that I could leverage it more? Or, you know, instead of making this one weapon, what if I could do something that could kind of have more broad appeal? And not necessarily in a way of like, I'm making a design decision I'm going to foist on people, but rather going, it feels like the product we're making is this, and I think this thing I'm doing would be better served in this way. Like, if I think about who I'm targeting at, I'm going to make my work fit into that. So kind of trying to see the bigger picture and not just getting stuck into what you're doing. Because a lot of times people would kind of get really narrow-minded and they'd come to me and say, I spent 3 weeks on this thing. And I was like, great, but that thing doesn't fit anymore. Like you kind of, you'd gone in a hole and you weren't talking to people and you weren't kind of like thinking about what you were doing. So the people I always liked working with the most was just like, people who are collaborative, people who are coming to me going, hey, I've got this other idea, or you've got this work, I think our work can be synergistic this way, or I'm thinking about the product, I think there's this opportunity for us. So yeah, really don't get too blinded into just what you're doing and try to really see how what you're doing is fitting into the bigger picture, because that just makes every decision more valuable over time. And the more you build up that muscle, like just the more responsibility and the more things you can do in the grand scope of the game, which just makes you more powerful, right? Like the more you can do that, the more you can kind of leverage your abilities.
Yeah, so soft skills sound extremely important then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Just had a quick question about with Modern Valve, particularly since they're actually acquiring a lot of new and young talent recently with Hoppo Games, who developed Risk of Rain 2. What would your hopes and aspirations be, especially working on such older titles, be for a new Valve game?
Yeah, it's a hard one. I mean, I've been out of Valve for 7 years now, so I don't really have a lot of insight into what they're doing. When I left, the company had certainly shifted away from thinking about single player, and they were very interested in VR, and they were very interested in the Counter-Strikes and Dota and kind of more games as service. That never resonated with me. I'm a single player person. I don't care for games as a service. I don't want to do that. So that was a big reason I was like, I'll go do something else. I'd love to see them get back to those roots, because obviously that's the thing. I think they did that incredibly well, and I want to play that as a customer, like instead of being behind the scenes, like I'd like to experience that like everybody else did. So that would be my hope, but it is hard. I think there's always this interesting thing where, yeah, the older generation has to kind of, you know, give over to the newer generation and do that, because I think I was always really like, I never wanted to tell anybody that something was impossible, because it might have just been impossible to me in the time that I came from, right? Like the younger people coming in go, yeah, whatever, I got this, and they could do those things. So I don't know. I'm excited to see what they can do, but yeah, I'm not sure what they're up to. So we'll see.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are going over time, but I am going to ask Pex for forgiveness instead of permission, and allow one more question. Okay, so. No pressure to the lady up there.
Yeah, I'm very sorry.
Give the mic to somebody. She's freaking out. She's freaking out. Oh my God.
Hey, Josh. Big fan.
Hey,
bro. Just a quick question. You're looking really fit, so I'm just wondering which gym you work at.
Hey, Andrew. It's Andrew. He happens to be at the gym that I go to. Thanks for coming out. I appreciate it. Yeah. But yeah, better by Sarah. That's the way to go. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Cool. All right. Good way to end it. I don't think I'm going to hand it to you to decide who should get the
Oh, that's
bucks.
Not fair. Oh, that's a tough one. that is a fair point. Put me on the spot. I think for me, yeah, no, I don't disagree. I think the industry thing is an interesting one. I don't know, maybe the speedrunning one. I kind of like that, because I All think right. speedrunning is kind of the new world. I do kind of appreciate that. If that's where the crowd wants to go.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Where's
the game developer? Come on down. Can savor it with your life.
That's right. But yeah, I'm sorry that I can't answer everybody's question. I do incredibly appreciate you all coming out today. Like,
no worries.
Super cool to see everybody here.
Cool. Okay, thank you so much, everyone. Josh will be at the bottom of the stage if you want to talk to him or get any selfies or fanboy or fangirl over him. Don't go too overboard though, because then you move from the fan zone into the weirdo zone. So don't do that. Thank you so much for sparing us your time. Thank you to the audio and video people. You guys don't get enough thanks for what you do.
Yeah, that's it, buddy.
Thanks. Thanks to the PAX enforcers. And yeah, have a good night. See everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.